Okay, you're back with us for another GoldSeek.com Radio Gold Nugget segment. Today's special guest, Peter Schiff from Euro-Pacific Capital. Well, would you believe that silver is higher by over 25% from the summer lows and gold is up about 10% from the reaction low? Joining me with his perspective on the precious metals sector, President and Chief Global Strategist of Euro-Pacific, welcome back, Peter Schiff. Well, last week, the precious metals touched a four-month record high point. Silver briefly crossed $25. Gold hit $14.34. Silver, as I was starting to mention, is higher now by about almost 30% from the summer low. Gold up about 10% from a low of around $12.73. From your perspective, is the bull market reaction bottom in place here?
Well, I think there's a good chance that it is. I mean, nothing is for sure. And we're having, you know, some weakness in gold and silver today, I think, in reaction to the better-than-expected ISM numbers, which showed the non-manufacturing sector expanding at a faster pace than I guess had been forecast. But you know, none of that is actually bad for gold. In fact, I think it's still bullish because all these the service sector, as it gets bigger, we need to import more products to sustain it, which means bigger trade deficits, more money printing. All that is bullish for gold. But I think people are looking at the Fed and they're looking for any indication that the Fed might begin to taper or might taper its QE more rapidly. So anything that shows the economy being stronger in the short run has been perceived as being negative for gold. But, you know, I don't think it even matters if the Fed tapers or not. I think the price of gold goes up either way. If we do get a taper, I think it's already factored in and it's buy the rumor, sell the fact. If we don't get a taper, then we get an even bigger rally. And my bet is that the Fed is going to be looking for an excuse not to taper, but ultimately to increase the amount of QE. And, you know, maybe if we start a war in Syria, that might be cover for the Fed to hold off. You know, they're looking for something. Meanwhile, look at yields. 10-year yields are now about to go through 3%. That's more than a 2-year high, and that's more than twice what the yield was on the 10-year at the lows.
Well, that's a great overview of many of the questions I had for you today. So let's sink our teeth into a few of them here. You know, some media sources are indicating that a showdown between the U.S. and Syria could lead to a new war front in the Middle East. And unlike some of its neighbors, Syria has considerable military resources. History shows that warfare has a tendency sometimes to get out of control and lead to unintended consequences, not to mention it's somewhat inflationary, as we tend to see government spending increase as it's required to fund operations. How important of a factor is this potential war with Syria for the precious metals investors?
You know, the main stage is monetary, and you know, whether or not we make the mistake of launching Tomahawk missiles into Syria, I think the price of gold is going to go higher. But you know, if we do it, it's certainly a positive from the point of view of the price of gold. I mean, that's not a positive for the world or for America. I mean, Syria represents no threat to the United States. There's no strategic interest for bombing them. So, you know, and even on a humanitarian, I mean, it doesn't, I mean, I think the Pope is out there saying not to do it. But, I mean, other than France, there's no other country that seems to be supporting the action that we're proposing to take, yet we want to do it anyway. And, you know, the biggest problem, other than the loss of life, which will surely result from these missiles, and, you know, they can say, well, we're just going to target military targets. You really have no idea who's going to die when you, you know, push these buttons and send these missiles headed into the cities. Even if the targets are military, who knows, you know. But the real problem, as you said, is the unintended consequences. You know, President Obama says this doesn't mean boots on the ground. How does he know? How does he know where this thing is going to play out? He may have no intention of putting boots on the ground, but circumstances may play out in a way that we end up with boots on the ground. And once we put the boots on the ground, how many years are they going to be there? You know, how much is it going to cost? What other enemies are we going to make? What's going to be the blowback? Nobody knows the answer to these questions, but we know that there's going to be answers, and I'd rather not even stir up the hornet's nest. Why bother when our national security interests are not being threatened by this civil war in Syria? And as far as I'm concerned, I don't even care who wins. I don't even know if the people who are trying to depose Assad would be any worse than he is. I mean, how do we know? I mean, you know, it could be an even worse regime that's going to take over. It's not like you've got some, real freedom fighters. It's not like the rebels or the founding fathers, you know, trying to set up a free market constitutional republic over there.
Perhaps we should be focusing more in the United States and how we have an economic malaise here. I mean, why in the world would you want to put the economy and our people in even more harm's way? In other words, why go to war when things are already economically struggling here and we've not fully recovered from the last great recession?
Well, it only makes sense to me from a political perspective. If the economy is really weakening, and the government, the president, has been telling this story of this recovery, and it appears obvious that the recovery is fading, or at least the illusion is wearing off, and interest rates are rising, this mini bubble they've reflated in the housing market is popping, and we're headed back down to recession, why not start a war? Because now you can blame that recession on the war. You could say, look, everything was going great, but now this happened, and so that's why the economy has had a downturn. But, you know, we had to do this. We had to do it for posterity. We had to do what's right. We couldn't sit idly by. And so now it gives the government, the Obama administration, a scapegoat, some kind of cover to blame the problems on. Oh, oil prices are up at $150 a barrel. But that's because of this war that we had to fight. And so, you know, yes, the economy is bad, but only because of this war, you know.
I really wonder how this is going to benefit the United States, because, as you say, oil prices are going to rise now no matter what we do. Certainly, as long as there's conflict and increased tensions in the Middle East, there's always going to be that question mark around our energy supply. But I wanted to move on here. You know, the global economy appears to be, at least on paper, in revival mode. I mean, we saw China with unexpectedly strong economic numbers. Conditions in the U.S. economy and the Eurozone are at least appear to be improving somewhat. This seems to be reviving the inflation theme, which could also be positive for the precious metals. Any thoughts?
I mean, of course. I mean, all wars are fought through inflation. I mean, they're not going to raise taxes to finance the wars. They just spend more money. And, of course, you know, the Fed is already threatening, again, we talked about tapering. I think this could be another excuse. This could be the excuse the Fed has been waiting for to say why it can't taper, because now the added uncertainty of the war, higher oil prices threatening to sap consumer spending, people worried about the war. So it could be a perfect excuse for the Fed not to taper, which is, you know, it's been looking for an excuse. And this seems like a credible one, because clearly the Fed couldn't have, you know, forecast that we would start a war. So, yeah, I mean, it certainly serves a lot of purposes for people who are looking for cover and looking for things to blame things on. But, you know, there is going to be more inflation. The question is, though, how is the dollar going to react to all this? I mean, if for some reason the dollar is seen as a safe haven from any Middle East tension, then that could temporarily slow the appeal of gold, because sometimes when the dollar is strong, gold's not. But if people, you know, correctly perceive that this is a negative for the dollar because it further undermines our economy and undermines our financial position, then to the extent that the dollar sells off and people look for alternative safe havens, then gold could really shine, you know, especially if we don't get the bump in treasuries. You know, we haven't had one yet. Bond prices keep on falling. There is no flight to quality here in the bond market, and if the bond market keeps falling, then people are going to be looking for a safe haven from bonds as well. And so gold would be, you know, an ideal place for people to take cover.
Well, you know, talk of economic recovery bodes well for silver. As John Embry pointed out recently, silver is less vulnerable to price suppression because it has much lower inventory levels. It's not hoarded by central banks the way that gold is and some other commodities. Do you have any thoughts on silver at this point?
Yeah, look, I'm bullish, and you know, we're at a key level here as far as putting in a bottom in a turnaround, this the current price here. Tomorrow's going to be a critical day. You know, we've got the non-farm payroll number coming out, which will be, you know, more important than the ISM numbers that came out. So we'll see how the market reacts to those numbers, and we'll see what those numbers are. But I think it could be a pretty big day tomorrow, you know, because if gold and silver react poorly and we get another big sell-off, then we may have to go back down and retest those lows. If not, if we can get a strong rally, then, you know, there'll be a stronger case for, you know, the real a bottom being in and a bigger rally coming.
Well, a new theme of rising interest rates is emerging. You alluded to that. Bonds and housing have reacted to the trend, and clearly some of those funds are flowing away from the sectors and into equities. When will some of that flow into the precious metals, or have we already started to see that?
Well, maybe we have seen it, but not in a major way. But when is money going to flow out of the equity markets? Because rising interest rates are a negative for the stock market. And some people think that maybe this back up in rates will make bonds look more attractive from an allocation perspective. But I don't think the bonds look attractive at all at these levels. The yields are much higher. In fact, if you look at 10-year Treasury yields, they've more than doubled where they were at the lows. And we were at the lows just a few months ago, basically. But even though the yields are twice what they were, you know, they're still too low. And if you look at the risk, if you look at a long-term chart of the bond market and where rates have been historically, it's still a long way up for yields and down for bond prices. So, you know, a 3% 10-year does not look attractive to me. You know, I don't think it'll look attractive to a lot of people, especially when they look at the direction. Because you could buy a 10-year Treasury that yields 3%, and then the yields can keep rising, and they rise to 4%. And now if you want to sell your bonds, you've lost 20% of your money or 15%. I'm not sure, you know, the exact number, but you'll end up losing many, many years of the cash flow that you are hoping to, receive by owning the instrument. So I think given how low the yields still are in their absolute sense, you're not going to get a lot of money flowing into bonds at these higher yields, but it could undermine the stock market because higher interest rates directly impact stock market valuations because you value a stock based on discounting it by an interest rate and discounting the earnings, and the higher the interest rate, the lower the present value of those earnings. Meanwhile, earnings will be negatively impacted as well by higher interest rates as corporations have more interest expense, as their customers spend more on interest, so they have less money to buy their products. So rising interest rates depress corporate earnings, which makes the numerator smaller, and then you have a higher denominator when you discount it. And so, you know, this is a big negative for stocks, and the stock market seems really complacent in the threat of these rising rates.
Home price, obviously a big component in the taper talk. We saw one of the largest drops in home sales, about 13.5% recently. That was in July, and seasonally adjusted rate, very low. This decreases the odds that the Fed is going to taper. I mean, economic stimulus is important, extremely important for housing, and housing is apparently one of the largest sectors and backbone, you might say, of this domestic economy that's been gutted.
The whole idea of a recovery is predicated on the housing market. I mean, Ben Bernanke said so himself. He's counting on the wealth effect of housing to sustain the recovery. And if he sees that effect working in reverse, which I think it's just begun to do, because home prices are going to be coming down now because the affordability is gone, because mortgage rates have gone way up and prices have gone up. So houses are, you know, maybe 30% more expensive than they were a year ago when it comes to how much you would have to pay in mortgage payments for this comparable property. And the Americans just can't afford it, especially given what's happening to the job market and to people's incomes and to the, you know, high level of debt that people have to service. We just can't support the housing market with these prices and these mortgage rates. So prices have to come down, and that reverses the wealth effect. And there goes the recovery that Ben Bernanke claims he's created and upon which he's basing the idea that it's now safe to taper. So as I said, he's going to be looking for a way to backtrack on the taper talk. And, you know, war in Syria, may be the excuse he's been looking for.
I mean, we did notice in the latest Fed meeting minutes that the Fed governors feel confident that the economic recovery is going well, but those housing figures, as I was alluding to, is going to change the entire scenario in their outlook by the time the next FOMC meeting rolls around in a few weeks. It's likely to keep the Fed, you know, with their profligate ways.
Yeah, the Fed has a long history of being overly optimistic and overly confident about future economic growth. It consistently got that wrong. And so I don't see anything different today. I think they're as wrong now as they've always been. And whether they're just wrong or they're just lying, I mean, a lot of it is confidence. A lot of times the Fed just tries to talk the economy up. They think, well, if we just pretend that we think things are getting better, then it will get better. Kind of like, you know, if we build it, it will come. You know, they're very sensitive to psychology. And even if they think the economy is going to weaken, the last thing they want to do is say that, because they think that simply by saying it, it will be so, because the markets will react to what they say. People will pull back on investment, anticipating the slowdown that the Fed is warning about, and so they don't want to make it a self-fulfilling prophecy. So we don't really know if it's ignorance or propaganda that we get from the Fed.
You know, well, Dr. Bernanke's tenure at the Fed expires next year. Dr. Larry Summers and Janet Yellen are high on the list of candidates for replacement there. Both are known for their dovish ways. Who do you think will ultimately replace Dr. Bernanke, and what will it mean for investors?
You know, it's neither one of the candidates represents any kind of departure from the failed policies that have produced all the bubbles and have put us in the position that we're in today. But whichever one is the worst, you know, I'm confident that's the one they're going to go with. You know, so whether it's Yellen or Summers, I don't really know. I think Summers, my guess is that Summers is worse, but I suppose if, not Summers, that Yellen is the worst candidate, so that's who I thought they were going to go with. But maybe if he goes with Summers, there could be some things about him I don't know, you know, because I'm confident that Obama will choose the worst possible candidate. I mean, I think is pretty consistent. And so, you know, that's what my guess would be.
Ultimately, the president's job, whoever they deem most likely to put into place the policies that will support their political ambitions. Let's pick the candidate, not that's best for the country, but who will help me to push through Congress, you know, the programs that will leave my legacy. Unfortunately, that probably will lead to a lot more government profligacy, spending, stimulus, and inflation. That's great for precious metals, but maybe not so great for the country.
All these decisions are political. That's why these guys are there. They're making decisions that are politically motivated.
That's the real crux of the problem here.
Right, well, that's why you need to have the government with as little involvement as possible in the affairs of the economy, because we want market forces allocating resources based on economic viability. We want individuals, in free trade with one another, setting prices, and we don't want a government to be in charge of the economy, because A, they can't be. No one is smart enough to figure it out. But B, their motivations are very different. They're trying to do what's best for themselves politically, and they have enormous power, and they use that power in a very destructive way. To try to benefit themselves at everybody else's expense. See, when you have power in the free market, people benefit themselves by benefiting others. It's the invisible hand. Everybody wins. But in government, government wins and we all lose.
You may have come across a recent article, actually this week in the New York Sun, titled "The Class Back Dollar." The author claims that the middle class thrived for about 150 years here in the U.S. when the dollar was backed by gold and silver, but now that it's controlled by, let's call it the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain, it's shriveling up. The economic models just don't hold up in real time. That fiat money always backfires, but who it hurts the most is the middle class. The middle class and the working class. I'd like your comments.
Oh, yeah. No, inflation is, it helps the speculators. It helps people who have taken on debt to accumulate other assets. But, you know, people who are working for a living, people who have savings, people who spend more of their incomes on the necessities of life, like food and energy, you know, they're decimated by inflation. I mean, inflation destroys their lives. It robs them of their savings, of the value of their wages. I mean, it keeps them forever, you know, behind the eight ball, you know, as they're constantly trying to swim against the tide. No, I mean, when we've had the most, the largest increases in standards of living for the widest majority of people, it's during periods of sound money and falling prices. And that's what you get with a gold standard. But with the fiat system we have today, you get ever-escalating inflation, and prices only go up. The only question is how much they go up in any given year, but they never come down. You know, and as much as the government likes to tell us how bad deflation is, A, it's not bad, it's good, but B, we never even get it. I mean, prices, you know, yeah, we do get falling prices, you know, in certain areas like, you know, technology. But, you know, if it wasn't for the government, prices would be falling even faster in technology, and it would be even better for us.
Isn't it ironic? The government has an unlimited checkbook. They can print as much money as they want, so of course deflation is bad for them. But for the rest of us, deflation, maybe not so bad. But the TF Metals Report agreed this week with silver market analyst Ted Butler that J.P. Morgan Chase may have cornered the COMEX market during the smackdown that we had earlier in this year. They claim that a monumental short squeeze is setting up as soon as December of this year. I'd like your take on the J.P. Morgan argument.
Been talking about a coming short squeeze in the gold market for some time. I do believe one is coming in both gold and silver, and yeah, it could be, you know, one of the mother of all short squeezes. But I think there are a lot of shorts that are in the market now that are going to be in a position where they need to cover. And what I've been writing about and speaking about is where are they going to get the metal? You know, when they were rushing to sell their gold, there were buyers. There were buyers that stepped up into the physical market to buy all the gold that was being liquidated. Sure, it moved the market down in price considerably, but there were real buyers that stepped up to the plate to pick up all that gold. But my thought is that the buyers that stepped up are not short-term traders. They're people that are committed to owning this gold that don't want to sell it at $1,500 or $1,600. They bought it to keep it. And so that the supply has now moved from the speculators to the long-term holders, and that supply is now off the market. And so when the speculators look to buy back their short positions, where are they going to get the metal? It's not there. Prices are going to have to rise dramatically in order to bring that metal back to the market. And I don't think the shorts planned on that. So I think they're going to get caught. And I think it's going to be very painful. You know, it's going to be probably, you know, a different emotion for the longs.
First, we saw Germany, Argentina, Switzerland. Now, according to sources in the past week or so, Poland, as a nation, is demanding the return of its leased gold reserves. Officials are demanding at least 100 tons of gold currently held in coffers in London, and it's been there for 70 years, I guess, you know, since the end of the last World War. They've been holding Poland's gold, and there's a big push to return that gold.
You know, this is the move. You know, bring back your gold. Don't trust the Fed. They claim they have it. Prove it. Ask for it back. You know, that's why we've been telling our clients to store their own gold. We sell clients gold at Euro Pacific Precious Metals. We ship it to them. They store it at home, you know, just to make sure that you have it. Don't necessarily trust somebody else with it. And I think a lot of nations are starting to feel the same way, that they want their gold within their own borders. They want to know that they've got it. And, you know, that just puts more pressure on the physical market. So, yeah, I think we prepare for the short squeeze, buy the dips. That's why I launched, you know, about a month ago, I launched my first gold fund, the Euro-Pacific Gold Fund. The symbol is EPGFX. EPGFX is the Euro-Pacific Gold Fund, and that invests in the gold miners, and I think the opportunities there are incredible, and I think these stocks are about as cheap as they've been in recent memory with respect to book value or relative to the price of gold. So I think there's some great opportunities there for the people who want to, you know, take a little bit more risk in playing the gold rebound.
A top Swiss gold fund manager noted this week that he's looking for $2,500 gold and $70 silver in the near term. I think that might be a bit aggressive, but he notes that even such lofty prices, if we meet those numbers, will not really reflect the true inflation-adjusted values, pointing to governments as still suppressing gold as they're running out of ammunition, as central banks have apparently sold off such a huge amount of their gold, China buying up much of what the central banks have divested. You know, we're kind of setting the stage here for another assault, if you will, on those former bull market highs. Any comments as we wrap up?
Yeah, I mean, I have no idea what they mean by the near term. Is the near term 6 months? Yeah, look, gold's going a lot higher. You know, there's no way to know how high or how quickly because there are a lot of factors beyond our control. And a lot of it has to do with trying to figure out when the masses who are totally clueless, who have basically been asleep and have no understanding of what's going on, trying to figure out when they're going to wake up, when they're going to figure out what we already know. You know, it's kind of like, you know the emperor's naked, but when is anybody else going to admit it? I know you don't know, but eventually it's going to happen. And when it does, you know, it's going to be pretty embarrassing for the emperor. It's going to be pretty difficult for the people who don't own gold when that happens because it's going to be a stampede. And a lot of people are going to try to buy at the same time, and there's not going to be a lot of sellers or can't probably be any sellers by then. So the price will move way up.
Well, I want everyone to get a copy of The Real Crash. That's America's Coming Bankruptcy, How to Save Yourself and Your Country. This is Peter Schiff's latest book.
And remember, you know, if people want to get more of my ideas and my thoughts, I do my own daily radio show, The Peter Schiff Show. People can listen online each weekday at schiffradio.com. You know, it's my last name, S-C-H-I-F-F radio.com.